The time of 8:15 having arrived, I call this meeting of the House Commerce Committee to order. A quorum is present. Our first order of business is approval of the March 19th meeting minutes. And Representative Perryman, have you had a chance to review the meeting minutes?
Yes, Chair Herr, I have reviewed the minutes from our last meeting, and they looked perfect.
Thank you, Representative Perryman. Representative Perryman moves approval of the meeting minutes for March 19th, 2025. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the meeting minutes for March 19th, 2025 are approved. Our first bill up today is Representative Liz Lee's bill, House File 1392. Representative Lee, if you can make your way to the testifiers table. I move House File 1392 be referred to the, my apologies. I move House File 1392 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Lee, you have some amendments, you have one amendment. Would you like us to move the amendment first before you speak to the bill, or would you like to speak to the bill first?
Let's move the amendment, but I guess I thought we were maybe moving to judiciary.
All right, my apologies for that. We are actually, there's a different motion on the table for Representative Lee's bill, so I move that House File 1392 be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Representative Lee, we have an A3 amendment. If you could describe the A3 amendment, we will move to put the bill in order. Mr. Chair, yes.
I was under the understanding from our conversations that this was going to be laid over, and now we're moving it this morning. Can you help me understand where the change came from our conversation previously?
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Lee could maybe address that.
Yeah, so I guess I was under the impression that there was maybe another motion, but if we want to lay over, we can lay over. That's okay. We're just waiting for all members of the committee to arrive. So that's...
All right, committee members, we're going to do a little reset this morning here. There was some communication last night. I thought we had certain understandings and whether this bill path was moving, but Representative O'Driscoll, I know I was waiting for some communication as well, and I'm going to, for the moment, because there seems to be some confusion around this bill, I'm going to move that House File 1392 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Lee, to your A3, please.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, members. So we're moving the A3. The A3 puts a cap on annual deposits into the fund of $5 million, and then there are other technical fixes.
Any questions for Representative Lee in the A3? Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the A3, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the A3 amendment is adopted. Representative Lee, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this bill, as amended, would create a restitution fund for people who have been found by a judge to have been frauded. Last year, it's estimated that Minnesotans lost more than $100 million to unscrupulous criminals through various frauds and scams. And we know that that's on the low end because many people who are tricked into these scams often don't report their losses because of shame. So, you know, as we know, unfortunately, the many innovations that have come into this digital age that have helped us have also been weaponized against many unsuspecting Minnesotans. And so I know we have limited time today, so I'm going to yield the rest of my time to testifiers and save comments for closing. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Lee. And we will take questions after the testifier. So the first one we have up is Thomas. Is it Elness? Mr. Elness, if you could go ahead and identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair Herr, Co-Chair O'Driscoll, and committee members. My name is Thomas Elness, and I serve as the State Advocacy Director with AARP Minnesota. On behalf of our more than 620,000 members statewide, I want to thank you for considering HF 1392. Minnesotans are tired of being scammed. And while AARP is leading the effort to protect Minnesotans from fraud through community education, our AARP Fraud Watch Network and Fraud Helpline, as you will hear today, criminals are becoming more sophisticated and preying on vulnerable Minnesotans. Joining me today are several of our members who will share their stories of being scammed. The impact of fraud is profound, particularly when victims are older adults who are at a time in their lives when they are least able to recover financially. There are few viable options for recovering money lost to scams, but a consumer fraud restitution fund, which is what this bill would do, can help address that problem in three key ways. First, this fund would incentivize those who have been scammed to report fraud. Too often, defrauded Minnesotans do not report the crimes that they have experienced. With an increased chance of restitution, defrauded Minnesotans have more reason to report their cases, which will help the state catch and hold more criminals accountable. Second, the creation of this fund incentivizes the Attorney General to pursue these cases. Without the chance of restitution in many scam cases, the Attorney General often prioritizes other cases. As things stand right now, public civil enforcement tools like injunctions and orders to pay money simply don't do enough to stop scam operations. Third, this fund will provide monetary restitution to those who have lost funds to criminals. And I've talked to several of you on this committee who have constituents that this has happened to. To receive restitution funds, the Attorney General would have to bring a case against a defendant as a consumer enforcement action and obtain a final order establishing that the person was defrauded. If I could just finish by briefly explaining the mechanics of the fund and how it would work, including how money would go into the Consumer Fraud Restitution Fund and then how money would go out. So first, how would money go into the Consumer Fraud Restitution Fund? Successful actions by the State Attorney General result in two types of money recoveries. First is restitution to consumers harmed by the defendant. The Attorney General today has authority confirmed by decades of case law and recognized in state law to collect restitution for consumers in an enforcement action. Nothing in this bill would change that type of recovery. Second, all other money that is not restitution for consumers in that case. So this is civil penalties, attorneys' fees, recoveries, the money generally paid to the state. It also includes money that couldn't be distributed to consumers as restitution because they couldn't be found or the like. This money currently goes into the state general fund under state law. This bill would place 50% of those funds, up to $5 million per fiscal year, into the fund. So that's how money goes into the fund. How would money go out of the fund? Money can only go out of the fund to pay restitution to consumers in Attorney General consumer enforcement actions where the court orders payment for consumer restitution, but where the defendant is insolvent for other reasons and the AG can't recover the restitution money from the defendant for the consumers. This means restitution paid to Minnesota consumers who are owed money from the consumer enforcement action but will never recover that money without the existence of this fund. There's no new authority for the Attorney General to bring consumer protection action here other than accessing the fund to pay consumers who are otherwise not going to be able to receive recompense from court-ordered restitution. Lastly, I would note that this bill would require the Attorney General to submit an annual report that identifies all the cases resulting in money into or out of the fund. I'll just finish by saying this, Madam Chair. AARP started this effort with several goals in mind. Help defrauded Minnesotans, slow down the number of criminal scams happening in Minnesota, and work in a bipartisan way, and it achieves all of those things. And I would note that the fiscal note is zero. So thank you for your time and attention, and I would respectfully ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elmas. And we have a couple of other testifiers here today. Is there a Dennis Anderson that is here? Please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
My name is Dennis Anderson. Chair Hare and the committee members, like I said, my name is Dennis Anderson, and I live in Maplewood. I am here to address the financial and emotional toll that many experience as victims of fraud and scams. Thank you for letting me share my story. It's not easy to sit here and talk about being scammed. It's a time in my life when I was vulnerable and alone, and those criminals took advantage of that. In October of 2023, I received a call that changed my life. The voices on the other end of the claimed to be my grandson and a public defender. They told me that my grandson had been involved in a car accident in St. Cloud with a pregnant woman. The caller, who said he was my grandson, mentioned that he had not doesn't sound like himself because he had a broken nose from the accident. And he pleaded to me not to let the rest of the family know what was going on because he was embarrassed. The supposed public defender provided case numbers and details. He shared that when my grandson was arrested, a police officer demanded to get a blood test to prove he was not intoxicated. My grandson refused the test, but the public defender managed to prove he wasn't intoxicated, which helped the case. Throughout the conversation, the public defender treated me like a friend, demonstrating that he was there for both me and my grandson. I grew to trust this person. So when the public defender said he needed $20,000 in cash for bail immediately, I didn't wait to act. I was desperate to help my grandson. I rushed to my bank, took $10,000 out of one branch and $10,000 from a second branch. The public defender advised me not to disclose the purpose of the money to the bank, as they might resist giving me the money for if it was for bail. Later, I received a call from the supposed court system confirming all the details and assuring me that the bond money would be returned. But the nightmare didn't end there. I received another call from the public defender who told me that the pregnant woman involved in the crash had miscarried and my grandson would be charged with manslaughter. He claimed he had negotiated a settlement with the woman and actually reducing the amount to be paid to her from $20,000 to $15,000, but it had to be delivered the next day. Running out of funds, I turned to my brother for help. He initially gave me the money, but called me the next day, suspecting it was a scam. Anxious to learn the truth, I called my grandson, who was safe at home and was unaware of what had transpired. I then reported the incident to the Maplewood police, and following my family's advice, I suggested to the police to set up a sting operation with the courier who was coming to pick up the $15,000. The courier was caught, but his involvement didn't lead to any of the scammers, even with the help of the police and the FBI. My initial $20,000 was never recovered. I cannot fully describe the emotional and financial toll that this experience has taken on me. The fear, the shame, the helplessness I felt was overwhelming. A consumer fraud restitution fund would have been a lifesaver, not just for me, but for many others who have fallen victim to these heartless scams. It's easy to think that you'll never fall for a scam, but it can happen to anyone. Scammers exploit our emotions, our fears, robbing us of our financial security. No one should have to experience financial, mental, or emotional distress caused by these criminals. I urge you to consider establishing a consumer fraud restitution fund to support fraud victims. We must ensure that no one else has to go through what I did. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson, for your testimony, and we appreciate you sharing your story today. Next on the list is Dawn Patton. Dawn, if you could identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Sure. Hi, Chair Herr and committee members. My name is Dawn Patton, and I live in Savage. I'm here today to speak on behalf of the countless victims of fraud and scams, including myself. Thank you for allowing me to share my story today. I sought help from what I believe to be a reputable online tech company to clear up some viruses on my computer. I spoke with someone claiming to be an employee of this company, who even provided me with an employee ID. Believing this was a reputable business and employee, I allowed him to access my computer remotely and guide me through the process of resolving the issue. Due to the volume of viruses, I was informed that my membership with this company will be refunded. They asked me to sign into my bank account, and they would do a direct deposit. On a separate screen, the employee directed me to enter in $200 for my refund. However, to my horror, I could quickly see zeros were being added, making the deposit amount of $20,000 before I could stop it. The scammers insisted that I needed to provide them with $19,800 in cash, claiming I had entered the wrong amount. We checked our checking account, and it did show a $20,000 deposit. They were very upset over my mistake and demanded the difference in cash so they would not have to report this to the IRS. In a state of panic, I went to my Wells Fargo bank to withdraw the cash. Thankfully, the bank recognized the scam and showed me how the $20,000 had been shifted from my savings to my checking account and that it was my money, not theirs. I had to file a fraud report with Wells Fargo and change all my passwords. I could have lost $19,800. This experience was incredibly stressful and deeply upsetting, and my sense of trust has been shattered. We need to safeguard Minnesotans' hard-earned money from criminals who exploit our emotions and target the most vulnerable among us. While I was fortunate not to lose the $19,800, many others haven't been as lucky. Losing that amount would have been financially devastating for me and has devastated far too many others. I urge you to consider establishing a consumer fraud restitution fund to support victims of fraud. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Patton, for sharing your story and being here today. Our last testifier is Jessica Whitney from the Deputy Attorney General. Please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. Jessica Whitney, I'm a Deputy Attorney General with the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. It's nice to be back in front of the committee again after our last week's testimony on consumer protection in general. This bill is a good follow-up on that testimony, and we want to thank AARP, Representative Lee, for bringing this bill. Our office supports it. We think it fixes a big gap that we have in getting restitution to folks, and it's sort of a gap in two types of scams. You've heard of one of them, sort of the real defrauders, right? The people that aren't there, that are usually not even in the U.S., that you can't track down. And the two individuals that testified today, those are the types of scams. They're also, and we've heard this testimony in other committees as this AARP has made its bill around, and we see it in the AG's office, are those folks who have, for example, legitimate businesses that have gone out of business and have no money left. We see that there's an AARP testifier that has testified in the Senate on Woodbury Dental, a dental office that went out of business, and she spent $20,000, $30,000 on implants, and that business is bankrupt, and she has no recourse to get the money back. And there's accusations of fraud there about what the dentist knew when he was going out of business, when he was losing his license. In our office, we have some solar energy scams, fraudsters that where maybe there's, again, accusations of fraud and how they were doing their business and what they knew and what they knew about their ability to provide solar funds. And all that money is gone, and people are out $20,000, $30,000 with no recourse. So this bill attempts to get restitution to both of those cases, the true fraudsters and where the folks have gone out of business, what seemingly a legitimate company. And it does it in a nice manner by taking money from fraud cases where we have excess, we have penalties, and we have legal fees after restitution has already been accomplished and there's extra money and filling them there. We feel like it fills a good gap, and we support it and would like to see it go forward.
Thank you, Ms. Whitney. And before I go to member questions, is there any members of the public who wish to testify in this bill? Just raise your hand, because I know I think I missed people the last time. So if you raise your hand, I can give you time to walk to the table. All right, looks like there are no members from the public, so we will go to member questions. Our first person is Representative Finke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Lee, for your bill. And I have a question for the testifier from the Attorney General's office. Hello. I'm just curious how far $5 million will go to solving this problem based on, you know, the case experience you have.
Ms. Whitney.
Thank you, Representative Finke. I think that's a good question. We're not sure because these are cases, especially in the fraudster cases, that we don't bring, county attorneys don't bring, because the fraudsters are long gone. They're hard to bring. They're hard to do. If they are brought at all, they're brought on a federal level, and you work in conjunction with the feds. So for us, it's really hard to tell how $5 million will be. I think it's our best guess, trying to keep it kind of low, working with Representative Lee on what would work. I think we could always come back and lift it. But honestly, it's a guess. It would be our mission, I think, in the AG's office to use it all up, and I think that would be accomplished.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, and I would just add that there is a section asking for a report because often, like in the case of Woodbury Dental, which we've kind of all seen in the Star Tribune, we don't know if someone's going to file for bankruptcy or like how much money they have to pay restitution to their victims. So that's part of not knowing, and that's why we have that provision for the report.
Representative Finke, any follow-up? All right. Representative Dotza.
Thank you, Chair. Here, question I would have is for the AG's office. How many of these cases are successfully prosecuted every year?
Ms. Whitney?
Thank you. Sorry, Madam Chair. Again, we have the two different types of cases. So the Woodbury Dentals, the solar frauds, we have several of those each year. The fraudsters, the true fraudsters, again, we usually don't bring them because they're gone. We look for them. They've disappeared. You trace them. You get whatever phone records you can. They might be in Nigeria. They might be in different parts of the world, South America, Europe, Canada. They're all over, and it's hard for us to find them. And so for resource-wise, then the money's gone, by the way, too, like when you try and track them down. So we currently don't really bring those cases, and neither do criminal prosecutors, neither do your county attorneys. So they don't get brought. But the idea would be they would be simple cases to bring in terms of you get a default judgment because no one shows up, right? Because you've got a defendant or a John Doe, if you can't track them down, and they don't reply. So you get a default judgment, which means an automatic order of entry of judgment in your favor. So that's the idea behind this.
Representative Dotseth. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Rep. Lee, for bringing this. I just wanted to say a thank you to those who testified on this. We heard from the AG's office how powerful a tool shame is in this unfortunate industry. And so today, just by sharing your stories, you have fought that industry, and thank you very much for doing that. I also want to point out something the AG said in previous testimony on fraud, that the number of frauds experienced even with young people in their 20s and 30s is the same level as those who are retired or in the latter stages of life. It's simply that those young people don't have as much money to lose, so we often don't hear as much about that and certainly don't talk about it as much. So this is a fund that would help just about every Minnesotan adult who can fall prey to these. So thank you for bringing this, and this is a really important bill.
Thank you, Representative Smith. I did have a couple of questions as well. Can you remind us, Ms. Whitney, how much, I don't know, maybe if just in the last biennium that we did get in fraud settlements?
Oh,
Ms. Whitney?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will have to get you that number. That is a good question. And the number, and I'll get it for the whole committee, we're happy to share. It'll be broken down into we get money for restitution, and then we'll get you what we got for other, for court fees, penalties, et cetera. And maybe someone has that. I know we gave a report on it. I just don't have it in front of me.
Representative Hewitt, were you raising your hand to answer the question, or you have questions?
No, I can't answer, but I have.
Okay, then I'll finish my last question. So, Representative Lee, is the intention of then the way this bill is set up is that it doesn't necessarily have to be your fraud case that gets settled. It's just any fraud case that is settled. Then these funds get put into in a separate line item for those who have been impacted by fraud to submit for potential restitution. Is that correct, Representative Lee?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct. So that's why Mr. Ennis went through kind of what goes into the fund and then what can be paid out. So, again, there are examples of like for instance, when the AG takes the opioid companies to court and they win a settlement, there is civil penalties paid. So right now that money goes to the general fund. If this were to be enacted, it would go into this restitution fund. And then, you know, on the output end, the folks maybe in this Woodbury Dental case, you know, who've lost their life savings would have been able to claim money from that fund. And so, yes.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Chair. And, could the person from AARP, the lobbyist for him, come back up, please?
Mr. Elmas.
Thank you. Representative Lee, this is a wonderful bill. Just a real quick question for AARP and possibly the AG's office. As an educated person holding a privileged office like this, I really am educated on this subject because I know, and when I get these calls, I kind of like to play with the people, especially when they bring up my sons and they're sitting next to me. But what are we doing more in AARP for educating our seniors and actually educating their children, too, to be watching for this? I know that that's a big lift for you because you have so many members. I became one. And so I'm wondering what you're doing to educate or, you know, because I don't know if social media works for this population as well as it does for the younger population. I'm just kind of curious what you're doing to help prevent this.
Mr. Elmas.
Madam Chair and Representative Hewitt, thank you for the question. AARP prides itself on being a leader in this space. So we have community education happening constantly, statewide, educating people on this. We also run the Fraud Watch Network, so are taking thousands of phone calls to track and help people that have questions about, is this a scam or is this not? And AARP is providing all of those services. We recognize the importance of education and ensuring that people are good consumers who understand scams and risks. I think what you've seen today is, despite all those efforts, the sophistication and nuance that is happening in the scam industry, as another representative called it, does ensnare some Minnesotans, and you've heard from some of them today. So we see this as part of a comprehensive strategy to both educate people, try to do as much we possibly can to prevent it, and then also help take care of the Minnesotans who are scammed.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair Hart. I actually want to thank Representative Hewitt for this question because I just want folks to know here and other members watching, the Department of Commerce actually has a specific unit, I guess, to target crimes against seniors. And so I have been working with them to do, you know, anti-fraud town halls across my district and in St. Paul. And so I'd encourage all members here actually to partner with the Department of Commerce that will send someone out to do a town hall and train your seniors. I've done this at their monthly lunches. And their curriculum is in partnership with AARP. So I'd encourage folks to do that. That is the education piece. And that's actually really important right now because, well, for one thing, if you can recognize a scam, you're 70% less likely to fall for it. But, you know, we no longer have the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And so, like, I think that's kind of one of the questions, like, how can we get ahead of this? Obviously, we can do that on a systemic level. But without this, what we can only do is on the back end. And it's this education piece, which we're very lucky to have here in Minnesota at our Department of Commerce. So I encourage all members to really reach out to them and bring these people to your districts.
Representative Hewitt, any follow-up?
Yes, real quickly, and then to the AG's office. Again, my concern for silos in our agencies, as Representative Lee just mentioned, Commerce has a senior fraud division, which actually the same one we talked about last meeting, she's contacted them. But I'm wondering if the AG's office also takes a role in educating and working with, like, cell phone companies to flag numbers, to work with the law enforcement to say, hey, these are things we're seeing, or does it go over to public safety? How does that happen when you identify a problem that maybe we don't know about yet?
Ms. Whitney.
Yeah, Representative Hewitt, good question. We have many mechanisms. We have lots of meetings with different organizations and groups. We, for example, meet with Commerce on regular. We meet with local law enforcement. We try and do education both of members, are of consumers. So we have senior road shows. We have schools. We're getting into the schools because I think it's important to start in high schools. So we were going to high schools. If you want us to come to a high school in your district, please let us know. We've reached out to high schools, but we welcome the opportunity to come to a high school in your district. We'll go anywhere. We try and go to college campuses and just general communities to educate. I will say, caveat, just an education piece for everyone in this room. We all think we won't be a victim of scam, but psychology shows the best way for you not to be a victim of a scam is actually to teach others, right? It's like you learn best by teaching others. And so I can tell you about the scams. You're still slightly more likely to be a scammer. But if I tell you I'm teaching you to teach others, you're more likely to internalize that. So I'm teaching you to teach others. That's what I'm going to tell you today, so you all won't be victims. But we also meet with, like I said, the different law enforcement, and we're trying to break down those silos because it's very important. And we meet with other state and federal agencies.
Thank you, Ms. Whitney. And I'm going to move on. We have a couple more members wanting to ask questions, and I would like to wrap this up in about 10 more minutes. And so I'm going to move on to Representative Van Binsbergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is for Representative Lee. Can you tell me, do you know the number of, this is a couple questions, I guess. Do you know the number of potential claims that you perhaps would see in a year? And then I'm curious of how the AG would pick what cases to take. And then is there a process for those that have, they've perhaps been unjust, they think they haven't, their cases haven't been selected, and is there a process for those folks as well?
Representative Lee.
I think this is probably a better question for Ms. Whitney, because they will decide the cases.
Ms. Whitney.
Madam Chair, Representative, that would be part of our current standard case selection prosecutorial discretion process that we take now. We have a complaint intake system. We also get complaints from local law enforcement, from BCA, from many different areas. We try and take them based on severity. There's no magical formula. I can't tell you A, B, and C. It is like many prosecutors, we kind of look at the totality of the circumstances, how much people are out, how many victims are impacted, what we think, what can we do? Does it look like we have good evidence? In these cases, you know, right now, again, neither us nor county attorneys are taking a lot of these true fraudster scams because the fraudsters are long gone and overseas. That will be out the window, so it'll be easier for us to take them on. I mean, I'm even envisioning maybe even like a law clerk project here where they just do our complaints and we do like default judgment, default judgment, default judgment. And honestly, I don't, again, it'll depend on how it all comes out, but I don't see us turning away a lot of people then if we could get that pipeline going. And it'll just be a matter of, is $5 million enough? If we can get default judgment after default judgment and we get a complaint intake system, again, weighing all those factors. But.
Representative Van Binsbergen.
No further questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair. To the author of the bill, many times the scam was referred to Woodbury Dental. I did a search, and there's over 20 dental services with the name Woodbury Dental in it. For the record, is this Woodbury Dental Arts owned by Dr. Marco Camel?
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, that's correct. No means, no intention to disparage the good people of Woodbury, which abut my district.
Thank you. I just want some clarification. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Cha, thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Cha, way to stick up for your community. I appreciate that. Madam Chair and members of the committee and Representative Lee, this is an important topic. There's no question about it. And a couple of questions and some highlights for you. Number one, this does have interaction with the general fund. As was testified earlier, the monies that come from these kinds of claims and recoveries go to the general fund, and we know that we have a problem with the general fund right now and also a bigger hole in the next 2 years out beyond that biennium. I'm not saying that that is the reason why we should or shouldn't support a bill. I'm just reminding the committee that good intentions also have good dollars that follow them. And so we make choices on how we're going to spend the taxpayers' money, and in this case, recovery money. And I also want to underscore something that the bill author, Representative Lee, talked about, and this is very close to home in this committee, and that is the wonderful work that the Insurance Fraud Bureau does in the Department of Commerce. And as this committee has learned earlier, that via executive order on January 3rd, the governor had removed that from the Department of Commerce and moved that over to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And I am on record, and I will renew my position on this in front of the committee and members today. I do not support that move. I do not endorse that move. I think that consumers will find that it's more difficult for them to be able to go through a more bureaucratic process when it was a fully, wholly, and solely contained a division within the Department of Commerce and was having great success in detecting and dealing with consumer fraud. And we know that fraud causes prices to increase, and we have a bill in front of us that talks about insurance later today and the cost of insurance going up. That is why the Fraud Bureau needs to be in the Department of Commerce. So I'm not using this as an opportunity to make a statement about my displeasure of the movement of the Fraud Bureau. My question is, will this become the next thing that goes under the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension because of, gosh, it's dealing with fraud, and we're building this big, huge conglomerate, and will committees be sitting here going, yeah, well, that was a great idea. Now we're moving it out of the AG's office, and we're moving over to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And I don't know if anybody has an answer. Representative Lee, I guess I'd like to ask you what your intentions are if this becomes law. Would you like to see it moved or kept in the AG's office? I think I know the answer, but I just want to have a little more discussion on the overall global topic of grabbing and moving stuff around in the state government. And I feel better now, though. But
and Representative Lee, since you do not speak for the administration or the governor, I don't know if you have any opinions to weigh on that or if Ms. Whitney does, but if you want to briefly touch on that.
Yeah, I feel like that would be stepping outside my wheelhouse a little bit. But I do just want to respond and say, you know, this bill was crafted with good intentions and also very intentionally, which is why it's only taking 50% of what would be deposited into the general fund. And then this is also why we adopted the amendment today for the $5 million cap. And so, you know, we all understand the budget situation we're in, but I'd also say, you know, we know who this money belongs to, and so I think it's also unfair to say we're going to balance our budget with the funds of people who've already been defrauded. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Lee. And so with that, I'm just going to have you, if you have any final comments before we lay this bill over.
It's a good bill. I just want to thank Representative Smith for bringing up that young people also get defrauded. Obviously, you know, I really appreciate the AARP members who've come today to testify and who've also come to be here in support. I believe there was also a storybook that was shared. It's a digital book of all of the stories of people in Minnesota who've been affected by this. And I'd say it's because they have life savings, they have 401ks. But on the other side, we've also seen an increase in scams against students for student loans because a lot of them, you know, have been canceled now or not canceled, and there's this ambiguity. And so our students are getting texts every day to, you know, refinance your student loans. So that's one way because that's their assets, I guess. So also do want to thank him for uplifting that and, you know, hope that this makes it somewhere in a final omnibus. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Lee. And so I renew my motion that House File 1392, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. And so the bill is laid over. Thank you, Representative Lee. Our next bill on the agenda is Representative Niska's House File 2233. Welcome to the committee, Representative Niska. If you can go ahead and since you are not a member of this committee, I will move that House File 2233 be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Representative Niska, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you to Representative Finke for joining me in support of this bill. I'm carrying House File 2233 on behalf of the Uniform Law Commission. It's a Uniform Special Deposits Act dealing with, right now there are deposits that go into financial institutions that are contingent on future events. They're important tools, but there's some uncertainty around that. And so the Uniform Law Commission has been working on this Uniform Special Deposits Act to remove some of that uncertainty. And I have with me here to describe more of the bill, Minnesota business attorney and a Uniform Law Commissioner, Kim Lowe.
Testifier, and since we don't have your name here ahead of time for testifying, if you could just identify yourself for the record and be brief with the with your testimony, that would be greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kim Lowe. I'm a business law attorney here in the Twin Cities, and I'm also one of Minnesota's Uniform Law Commissioners. I think I've been here already this year, but I'm here to talk about the Special Deposits Act, which is a bill that has been created, and the hope is it moves around the country, to enable special deposit accounts to be properly labeled and structured with agreements. It doesn't require banks to do it. It doesn't require a name to do it. But the hope is that when these accounts are established and they're clearly labeled as special deposit accounts, that the framework of this bill will protect those accounts under circumstances where one of either the depositor or one of the other parties might be in a situation where those accounts could be grabbed. I'll put it in a simple sort of explanation on where these occur. Typically, these occur when people have what are called escrow accounts. They also occur when we establish accounts for security deposits, when between landlords and tenants, oftentimes when people rent, they're required to make a security deposit. Under the law, that security deposit is supposed to go into a separate bank account. That separate bank account is supposed to earn interest, and it's supposed to be protected. That security deposit sits there through the term of the lease, and it's available to the landlord in the event something happens, but it's also supposed to be returned to the tenant at the end of the lease. That's how this is set up under law. Those accounts are not always set up that way. Other accounts that we tend to, we all interface them in some way or circumstances are escrow accounts. They're often set up as escrow accounts. Not every bank has an escrow account agreement. A lot of times money is put into an escrow account when you purchase a home, when you are buying or selling a property or a business. A lot of times they'll go into an escrow account and they're held there until circumstances come to pass where the money is either returned to the depositor or it's given up to some other beneficiary under the account. What the Special Deposit Act does is it creates a very clear framework that says these accounts are not property and they are not subject to bankruptcy. They're bankruptcy remote accounts in the event the depositor or one of the parties goes through a bankruptcy proceeding. It creates a protection framework. It's not meant to keep funds from being available in bankruptcy, but it's really meant to protect the parties who are not in that process to make sure those funds are still there and available. It's a pretty simple act. It's not requiring banks to do anything. It's not requiring parties to do anything. It's creating a framework that we hope goes throughout the country to create certainty around these accounts so that there's certainty when they are used, there's certainty for all the parties.
Thank you, Ms. Will. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill as well? Seeing none, member discussion. Any questions for Representative Niska? Seeing no discussion, Representative Niska, any final comments?
No, thank you very much for the opportunity to hear this bill, and I appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Niska. I renew the motion that House File 2233 be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. House File 2233 is re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Thank you. Our next bill on the agenda is Representative Finke's bill, House File 695. Welcome, Representative Finke. And would you like to move your bill, or would you like me to go ahead and move it?
Go ahead, please, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Finke, I move House File 695 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. It looks like we have one amendment to this bill, the A1 amendment. Representative Finke, if you could speak to that bill, to that amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. This amendment is in alignment with what was adopted as an amendment in the Senate. It just makes a few clarifying remarks in the bill, clarifies policy and when it's necessary, and get the bill in the shape that we're working with.
Thank you, Representative Finke. Any discussion to the A1? Representative Crenshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author of the bill. How does this actually clarify? As I'm reading through it, I see We removed entertainment, but we've left the entertainment venues, and we've changed that to occupancy. And you said this clarifies when and where. So how does that actually do that? I'm not. To me, it seems like it opens it up more.
Representative Finke.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. So the first half of the amendment really is just cleaning up some drafting. The second half, you can see we've deleted bottled. We've added factory sealed in the second option. And then the third one is really the key piece in how we clarify the types and sizes of water bottles in order to protect the safety of others. So really what we're doing is we're bringing the options, right? This is a bill, and we haven't explained the bill yet, but it provides several options for places of entertainment to provide water. And so that line at the end really clarifies some of the concerns that were raised.
Representative Cresha.
And Madam Chair, I realize this is the author's amendment, so I'll have other questions. So I think I'll just allow, we'll adopt the author's amendment, then I'll take it when we get to the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Cresha. Any further discussion to the A1? No further discussion. All those in favor of adopting the A1 say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay?
No.
The motion prevails and the A1 is adopted. Representative Finke, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 695 is a bill that allows people to have water for free. It is without doubt the most popular bill that I have ever introduced. Across the aisle, every single person that I have ever talked to about this bill is excited at the opportunity. So what it does is it provides three options for places of entertainment as defined in our statute to provide free potable water to attendees at music festivals, concerts, football games, any kind of space where you are going to a large crowd. And there are tickets. Usually these events are ticketed, though not always. And what we know is that there are many events that take place that are hot. They are in the summer. The initial need for this bill comes from hot summer events in which access to water is inconvenient or sometimes expensive. And then the second need was really met by the idea that a family is, you know, maybe spending $200 on tickets to an event, and then they have to spend $7 to get water for their kids. We want to make sure that people have safe drinking water and it is available no matter what you're doing, where you are. It's extremely popular. It moved through Senate without controversy, and I'm hopeful to have your support today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Finke. Before we go to member questions, we do have a couple testifiers here today. Our first is Joe Carlson. Please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm Joel Carlson, and I've been before you several times already. And in my business, I represent Minnesota United, the professional soccer team that is just down University Avenue. And we have a new stadium, Allianz Field, that we're very proud of, and we want to talk a little bit about that. In addition to representing Minnesota United, I work with venues like Live Nation, and I've been on the Amateur Sports Commission since 2003. This is a really important issue, and when it was first introduced, what we did with venues is we went to find out what's happening in the marketplace. This is going on right now, and we're happy that it is. Most venues allow you to bring in an empty water bottle, and that's a good thing. They provide water. Our clients, my clients, provide water at their venues. Allianz Field was designed with watering stations all around the stadium. So this is happening in the marketplace, and that is a good thing. And I can tell you, at least for the venues I work with, they do provide watering stations at outdoor festivals, free water. All we would like to see out of this bill is clarity and consistency so that we have a uniform law. And our preference in that for my clients, I've expressed this to Representative Finke, and they've been really great to work with. We allow patrons to bring in a clear, transparent plastic bottle to be refilled. We really have concerns about bringing in a 40-ounce Yeti that's a projectile, right? So we want to have the ability to control the types of bottles or vessels that come in to be refilled. And we've talked about that in the amendment that Representative Finke just described, to say the venue can limit or address that is very helpful. We think that we can maybe even go further and just set a floor. You can bring in a clear plastic transparent bottle to be refilled. And then if a venue wants to do something else on their own, that's fine. Our concern is that we're going to have a fan conflict. I can bring a Big Yeti to this venue, but I can't to this one. And they show up with it, and then you've got a fan conflict. So we were thinking a floor, like TSA. It's got to be empty. It's got to be so you can see in it. Is a good idea, but those are resolvable issues, Madam Chair. We're happy to work with the authors on this, and I want you to know that it is going on in the marketplace. We have over 4 million visitors that come to the Amateur Sports Commission campus in Blaine a year, and we do provide this amenity for them. It's just critically important when you're in, have 10,000 kids at a soccer tournament in the summer, that you provide the water, and we're very much in tune with what's going on with this bill. Happy to answer questions, Madam Chair. Oh, can I add one more thing, Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Carlson.
Some artists, some speakers have specific rules in their contracts about what can and can't be brought into an event. And we want to make sure that we can honor those requests. And we don't want to say, well, if this speaker says he doesn't want bottles brought in, that we won't provide water. We'll still provide the water and a means to access the water with a cup or however you get to it. But some particular contracts kind of preclude us from allowing a water bottle to come in. We want to make sure that we're aware of that as this moves forward, so that we're addressing that concern. Thank you, Madam Chair. We're happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. If you could stay close by, it sounds like there might be some questions. And next is Adam Yust. Please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Chair Herr and O'Driscoll, members of the committee, my name is Adam Yust. I'm with the University of Minnesota Office of Government Relations. I want to thank Rep. Finke for working with us on this issue and share a couple comments about HF 695. The University of Minnesota is complying with much of the proposed legislation to ensure that students and guests have access to water at events on our campuses. There are two areas that I would like to offer feedback regarding places of entertainment, which include performance and exhibit spaces. For example, a visiting speaker at Northrop Auditorium on the Twin Cities campus may require in their contract that no one bring any type of water bottle or other possible projectile inside the space for security concerns. Additionally, the Tweed Museum of Arts on the Duluth campus does not allow water bottles of any kind inside museum galleries to protect artwork. In both of these examples, free water is available within the larger structures of the building, just not in performance and exhibit spaces. We would like to continue to work with author on language to provide clarity on indoor museums and theaters, as well as instances where there could be security concerns. Thank you, and happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Mr. Yust. Is that correct? Thank you. Are there any members of the public who would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will go to member questions. Representative Kreshaw, we'll let you continue your questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the bill author, I appreciate where you're going with this. You said there was three items. You mentioned free potable water, and then you stopped, and you didn't get the other two. So I'll start here. I think where you're going and the horizon you're heading for, I agree with. When it comes to a large sports venue, whether it's – I won't say the teams, and we have those. Those tickets are expensive, and you should be able to get water there, 100%. I take my family in there. That is a huge economic burden. Where the disagreement comes in, as I look at your bill, I don't think this bill gets there, because if we're trying to solve the problem of me going to a sporting event or event, and I take my kids and the water's super expensive, and that's really bad – that's a horrible problem. We should. I'd rather see a bill that just says make them give me free water and name them. What we've done here is we're starting to get into unintended consequences. So Here's, and bear with me, I have a series of questions that I'm trying to figure out, because I'm thinking of the venues in the districts that I go to. So to the bill author, first of all, what would be the penalties, who reports, and what would be the requirements of, say, a venue in a district that has 100 people show up and their security like the sheriff? What are their obligations and requirements? Do I go to them and say, hey, I couldn't get access to water? So to the bill author.
Representative Inkey.
Thank you, Chair Hurt and Representative, for the question. The intention would be that person would be denied access to the event if they're, well, you're saying the event doesn't have water. So let me set the stage for this a little bit, because I think both of the concerns that were raised here are actually addressed in the language of the bill, and I'm happy to have nonpartisan talk through how that would happen. The idea here is that people are mostly complying with this law, and some folks are not. And if an event is not providing water, we do not have a penalty in here, and it would be a pleasure to put a penalty into this bill if for actors who are not participating in the rule of law that we're trying to create. But at the moment, we are putting the onus on the event organizer to provide water. And if they're not providing water, presumably there would be a case that we could certainly add a penalty if you would like to see one.
Representative Crenshaw.
So just so I'm clear, so the bill, so there's no penalties, no reporting at this point. So there really is no teeth to this bill.
Representative Finke.
Currently there is not. We are resting on the goodwill of our organizations and companies to put this into practice. But like I said, I would love some teeth.
Representative Crenshaw.
Thank you. So then, I'm not trying to, I really don't want to make this there's no animosity. I'm trying to get to, here's my next question. So let's say we put this in place. What prevents a Minnesota team, and since we have Mr. Carlson up here, what prevents them from saying, well, here's the free water, maybe even lesser quality that's in an igloo, but here's our premium services, and we'll charge you for those? So to the bill testifier, how would we stop them from using this? A good marketer would turn this around and make a lot of money.
Representative Finke.
I'm not quite sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand the hypothetical here being that Live Nation or somebody would serve bad quality water to their customers. That strikes me as a particularly bad business practice. I suppose somebody could serve bad water to their customers. I don't know why that would happen. As Mr. Carlson said, Live Nation has an exclusive contract for water with Liquid Death. For folks who aren't familiar, that's like a heavy metal themed water company, I think. That's an expensive tall boy can of water that they serve at the bar. And if you wanted to have potable, presumably tap water from the city, or whatever regular potable water access is available to the community, that's what would be served. If a company truly decides that they want to serve low quality water for free, I guess I welcome their demise.
Representative Crenshaw, before I come back to you, I do just want to ask nonpartisan staff, I think regarding your first question, I think they may have a response to that.
Thank you.
Chair and members, Representative Crenshaw, to the extent, so this is coded in Chapter 325F, which is a consumer protection statute, and then it's governed by the Attorney General under Statute 8.31, allowing them to accept complaints, use their subpoena authority, and apply penalties, but that's just to the extent that it involves business or commerce. So I think outside of those situations, the Attorney General wouldn't have enforcement authority.
Representative Crenshaw, any follow-up?
Yeah, so to the testifier, so I'm not, I think there's a little more defensive flippancy that I'm looking for. If a venue, what prevents a venue from saying, and you use quality, I was using quality in terms of access, what prevents a venue from filling up an igloo, saying here's your free water, and then charging premium service? That to me reeks of disparities. Those that have the money and the means to pay for the ticket and to go get water can do it, but those that maybe have won a ticket or coming in and scraped their money, they're left going to an igloo with a water bottle that no access that 300 other people are trying to get to. That seems to be incredibly disparate. Am I missing something? What prevents us from those bad business practices, Madam Chair?
Representative Finke.
Yeah, I appreciate this. I'm not trying to be flippant. I just think Liquid Death is hilarious.
I don't.
That's fine. I think that what that would be to me, like what you and I are getting at here is a philosophical difference about whether or not corporate entities and businesses and organizers are going to do what's in the best interest of their customers, right? Buying a ticket to the Vikings game is already a massive disparity in our communities. People who go to the Vikings games, they have money, they have the ability to purchase those tickets, or they save that money because that's a very special event for them. And it would be on our organizers. And like I said, most of the people who are going to be under this are already doing this in a way that respects their customers. If a business chooses not to do that, sure, they legally are allowed to do that. I would think that would be something no business would want to do. But if they want to treat their customers poorly, yeah, I mean, of course, they can do that. Laws allow businesses to treat their customers poorly. I would love to legislate that out of existence. But that doesn't change what this bill is trying to do, which is that these are places where people need to have real, reliable access to water, both for safety and for economic reasons.
Madam Chair, I just have closing comments.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, and thank you for allowing me to go. So, Representative Finke, here's how I see the difference. The market, as Mr. Carlson, they're already figuring that out. They're already figuring out how they can get water to folks. They want them to come back, buy the tickets, buy the concessions and all that. Where I think this problem is going to have unintended consequences is it rolls down to the smaller venues. I'll take them in my district. Let's say we go to a golf outing, and I look at you have places of entertainment. 95 kids show up at a museum for a school day. Five other kids walk in, they've hit the 100 threshold. Now the water has to be provided to them. I mean, we are setting up scenario after scenario and using government to allow the businesses that can to set up premium services, and they will, and the ones that can't be forced into a situation where someone could make a complaint for them. I mean, if I'm on a golf course and I have a golf outing, are we now delivering free water to everyone for a fundraising event? If I go to a Nordic skiing event that my kids participate in, do we have to deliver it all over the course because there's over 100 people? These are venues of entertainment. If there are 50 people, we heard the U of M, and 100 protesters show up for Palestinian rights, are we now providing water to them? This bill will say you have to.
It doesn't.
It does. It says 100. It says 100 attendees. I read through it. You're deleting. When occupancy is 100 attendees, so when 101 shows up, this could fall into effect. And if it doesn't, then we should make it clear. So my opposition is the vagueness and the unintended consequences that roll down. The last thing I would bring up is I'll just invite 99 people to the next graduation party and my mother-in-law's out or my brother-in-law's out or something. I mean, we're going to put ourselves in terrible spots with this bill. So I think the market is doing it fine now, and I think when we try to over-regulate it, we're going to get the consequences we deserve. So no further questions.
Thank you, Representative Crescia. And I think that to maybe help center us on this conversation, nonpartisan staff, can somebody just define the word event venue or venue that is defined? Because I think that we are sort of conflating personal events with events that are not venues to events that are just, you know, and so there's actually a clear definition in statute what that is. If there's someone in nonpartisan, Laurie, can you just maybe share that definition so that we can help focus our conversations today to the scope of this bill?
Sure. Chair and members, this definition comes from the statute regarding the sale of event tickets online. It's in 325F676, and it reads, place of entertainment means an entertainment facility, including but not limited to an amphitheater, theater, stadium, arena, racetrack, museum, amusement park, venue, club, or other place where performances, concerts, exhibits, athletic games, contests, and other forms of entertainment are held. And it does not include movie theaters.
It does not, I'm sorry, Ms.
It doesn't include movie theaters.
It does not include movie theaters. And would it include a museum, like the testifier had mentioned, just a regular museum?
If they're having an event of some kind.
Okay, thank you. And I hope that as we ask questions to our testifier, if we could keep the definition of a place of entertainment in mind so that we stay focused on the conversation. Representative Finke, did you want to comment? I do have a couple, a number of people wanting to ask questions. But, okay, thank you. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, first of all, to one of the witnesses here, I would just like to thank you for thinking about projectiles, because I usually are at the end of those when I make a bad call or something. So thank you. But to the testifier, I want to mention that you had a talk with my high school yesterday, and we're already planning to look at how we're going to do this, and we already have three or four sponsors that came out to provide the water. And so we're looking for other means to do it, and we think it's a great idea. We've had kids pass out at football games. So we have like 5,000 people show up to our games. And so this is something we're really looking forward to taking on as our next challenge. And the other thing is with all due respect to my friend and colleague on the other side of the aisle, Representative Krisha, anything we sell at the concession stand or give away free, because we've done this, we're liable for. So we have to have that under our school license and stuff like that. So I would imagine any venue that whips up something in an igloo cooler would also have that same issue. But after talking to Representative Finke and she talking to my athletic director, we're looking at opportunities here. So thank you.
Thank you. And next up is Representative Katiza Watun.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Finke, for bringing this bill forward. I signed on basically as soon as you told me about it. Water is life. And I think that a lot of the hypotheticals that have been brought up already in committee today are just in bad faith. It very clearly gives an option for places of entertainment to allow people to bring their own bottled water into a space of entertainment. The idea of a protest was brought up. I don't think that, you know, the security in places where people may be protesting are going to be like checking people's bags to see if they brought in their own water and being like, oh, that's why you can't be on this space right here. Like, people who want to come and protest are probably going to bring their own bottled water, and I don't think that that's going to be a question. Most places, most museums, most gyms, most concert halls that I've been to have a bubbler. And it's not like hidden or obfuscated during these events. But I have been to a ticketed event in the nitty gritty Granite City, Representative Perryman, your area, at the convention center, where the bubblers and water filling stations were obfuscated. They were hidden behind advertising banners so that my family and I were not able to access free water. Some of the booths at this event were actually giving out free water, which was very helpful. But that's what we're trying to potentially legislate here. Like, there is already potable water in these locations, and trying to block it off so that people can't access free water that they need during these events is the problem. So that then we have to go to the concession stand and pay $6, $7, $8, $9, $15 for a bottle of water, which is outrageous. And it's not healthy for the attendees, and it's bad business practice. So why would you block free water from people accessing it? And I think that this bill really gets to the heart of that. So I appreciate you bringing this forward.
Our next member is Representative Dotseth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to grab a sip of my water before I speak here. I have to, Madam Chair, Representative, I concur with the Representative Krisha on some of his concerns. I think some of the unintended consequences, we have to work through this a little bit further and see if we make this bill better. The concern I have is nothing's free. At the end of the day, a vendor is going to pass that expense back onto the consumer that's attending that event. I heard the discussion about 5,000 attendees. That's an awful lot of water. If we just add it up as a dollar a bottle, that's $5,000 right there. Is that correct? That could be passed on to a school system that for unintended consequences. So I think we need to just work through this, and I understand the heart behind what you're trying to do here, so don't take me wrong, but I think we need to work through this and make this better. Thank you.
Representative Dotseth, was that a question or just a statement? A rhetorical. Thank you, Representative Dotseth. Representative Finke, did you have a response, or do you want me to move on to the next testifier?
I can save my remarks for the end.
Thank you, Representative Finke. And we have six people left, and I want to wrap this up to give the other two bills some time as well. So if you could be very concise with your questions. The next person is Representative Davis.
I'll pass.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just want to get a couple of clarifications on here. I want to make sure that we have legislative intent if there's are challenges or questions about this in the future. So Representative Finke and or folks who are putting this forward, I generally understand why we're doing it. My question is, in St. Cloud and Representative, in the city that Representative Perryman and Representative Wolgamott represent, there is a large aerial display that occurs on the 4th of July that is in a public venue in a public area. We talk about ticketed events. Would this event that they have no idea how many people are going to attend, weather driven, that they may end up having to incur costs to have free water for attendees, how would that venue be treated under this law?
Representative Finke.
Thank you for the question, Madam Chair, and Chair O'Driscoll. No, there would not be that. What you described is not under the definition of place of entertainment. If it's a public event in a public park.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then there's another event that happens in Representative Wolgamott and Representative Perryman's City of St. Cloud, which is called Summertime by George, which is actually put forward by the business community that ends up donating money to a number of local charities and community-related events and activities. And they retail beverages and food and different kinds of things. It is not a ticketed event. Would this, because it's held in a public space with an amphitheater, be somehow brought into the conversation on this as well?
Representative Finke.
You know, I appreciate the question, Chair O'Driscoll, and thank you, Madam Chair. I think that it's important to be able to have these lines drawn, and I think, you know, I've worked very diligently around what the place of entertainment means and what the organizers who would be behind these events would be responsible for. I'll answer your question in just a second. But I also want to let the members know that I have talked to many event owners, venue owners, people who are doing these things, and they come to me and they say, this is unworkable. And then I say, this is actually what the bill does. This is the options it is providing. And every single one of them is recognize that this bill is not asking them to do very much. It is asking them to do, in fact, very little. You can choose one of three choices to provide water. I would like us to believe in unison that having water at summer events, whether or not the law requires you to as a place of entertainment, is a goal that is just worthwhile. And the purpose of this, the reason I don't have teeth in the bill, the reason I don't have us punishing these companies is because providing water to people when they are hot, when they are passing out, when they are in a crammed event, when they are passing out, when they are at a political rally by certain individuals who have no water and no bathrooms provided, that's wrong and we shouldn't do it. And I believe that companies want to do that. So whether or not the business chamber's public event is required by law, I would say no, it is not required by law. It is my hope that we would understand the value of having a summer event that provides free water to people who are attending.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this will be my last comment on here. I do think the bill has some merit, but I'm very concerned because in the statute, the part that gives me a little bit of heartburn is in the definition that's cited in the bill, and that's section C or subdivision C. The last part of that says, and all other forms of diversion, recreation, or show. And I have no idea what that means, and I have a sneaking suspicion that we'll have some challenges along the way as to whether something was or was not a part of that. We have in my community a lot of artists that put together things that travel from park to park. And although it's not a completely ticketed event, they do ask for donations and they do have limited venue and different things. I would really hate to see these folks who are trying to do some good things in the community end up getting caught crosswise on this. And so I would like some additional clarification of language on this because that part in here, all other forms of diversion, recreation, or show, really doesn't provide comfort to me with these other local groups that might charge $5 for a ticket as a fundraising event so that they can manage how many people they need to have and bring staff accordingly and comply perhaps with other local ordinances of law enforcement or other people in public safety and things. You're well-intended, I understand that, but I'm just wanting to make sure that we don't have unintended consequences. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Finke.
As long as that traveling music show in the park doesn't prohibit people from bringing a bottle of water, they're fine. I don't understand why they would say, you can come see our park show, no one is allowed to bring water. If that is happening, that would be against the policy. I've never heard of such an event in a public park.
Thank you, Representative. Members, we have 5 more people on the list, and since we are laying this bill over and it is not moving out of the committee, there will be additional time to have discussion on this bill. We do have a bill that will need to move out of this committee, and so I would like to make sure that that bill gets out of here. And so with that, I know that we still have 5 more members who want to speak, but I'm actually going to ask Representative Finke to wrap up on the bill. I will just remind this committee that it sounds like many of the venue questions that were brought up were mostly outside of the scope of what this bill would cover. So I would ask that if we have questions that we maybe have Rep. Finke come talk to you to provide clarification on the specific scenarios that you might be looking for so that you can get assurance that you may need. Representative Finke, comments to wrap up your bill.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the lively conversation. I think that most of the questions that were received on the bill are actually answered. Most of the questions that were answered were asked about this are outside of the scope, as you said, but I did want to address a couple of things. One is security. The bill does allow for places to create policies specific to the needs of their events, so were there to be a public figure who was coming to an event, you would not be required to allow people to bring bottled water in or their own water bottles. There is a very clear option in the bill that allows people not to bring things in. Like Representative Hewitt, I have been one of those people who has projectiles thrown at them. I think the idea of banning projectiles is very difficult. We've seen how far people will go to throw something at people they don't like, but we certainly don't want that to be our water bottles. I also will say that the intention of this bill is to ensure that large public events in the summer or in very populous stadium events where we see every year people suffering from a lack of water, we see people dying at these events, and that's legitimately true because of a lack of water. That is what we are talking about. We are not talking about the issues that were brought here. The bill received no controversy in the Senate. I think this is a very good, very popular bill, and I would love another opportunity to have conversation about it because this is the first time anyone ever has come to me with a dramatic list of problems. So I want to work on those problems. I want to move the bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Finke, and the bill is laid over. The next bill on our agenda is Stevenson Bill, House File 1289. And I move House File 1289 be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Stevenson, it looks like there are no amendments to your bill. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so we will, if you want to just give us some opening comments regarding your bill, and we'll move to your testifiers.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. About 6 months ago, the U.S. Surgeon General called for social media platforms to bear warning labels similar to those that are on packs of cigarettes and alcohol and other products. Today I'm bringing to the committee a bill that implements that recommendation. The bill also contains a section requiring social media to have pop-up notifications every 30 minutes, informing the user how much total time has been spent on the platform. Members, the evidence is clear. Social media has a significant negative impact on mental health, particularly for kids. 95% of children ages 13 to 17 report using a social media platform, with more than a third saying that they use social media almost constantly. Gallup found that the average teenager spends 4.8 hours every day interacting with various social media platforms. 4.8 hours. This is not an accident. It's not happenstance. This is how social media companies make money. They optimize their platforms to keep people looking at them as long as possible. Several studies have documented the direct link between excessive social media consumption and poor mental health outcomes. including loneliness, depression, anxiety, sleep disruption, memory loss, eating disorders, self-harm, and even suicidal ideation. Members, we're failing kids and we're failing parents because we're not adopting the public policy solutions we need to control this problem. We're going to look back at this time and social media companies the same way today we look back at big tobacco in the 50s and 60s. We think, why on earth did they allow people to smoke cigarettes in airplanes? How could they have done that? 50 years from now, they're going to look back and go, why were they letting teenagers spend 5 hours a day on TikTok? That's insane. We need to do something about this problem. Warning labels are not the end-all be-all. It's not a complete solution. But, you know, this is not a case where there is a silver bullet. We're going to need silver buckshot. We're going to need a lot of different smaller solutions. Warning labels have been effective in other public health areas, including tobacco. And it seems like a common sense solution going forward to educate the public about the dangers of excessive social media use. Thank you, Madam Chair. I do think there are testifiers.
And if we could have our testifiers ready, we have one that is on Zoom and one that is here. First is Eric. I might be saying your last name incorrectly. Is it Mishy? Please identify yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee, my name is Eric Mishy. I'm the CEO of SAVE, Suicide Awareness Voices of Education, a 36-year-old Minnesota-based national nonprofit committed to suicide prevention. I'm also here as a member of the Kids Keep It Digitally Safe campaign contest, a global alliance fighting for social media warning labels. We stand in unwavering support of this legislation because the dangers of social media are real, immediate, and deadly. And we need to look no further than the recent incident with the Minnesota State Senator. According to FBI documents detailing his arrest, Minnesota law enforcement placed advertisements for commercial sex on at least two websites known for facilitating human trafficking. These websites are publicly available on the internet and are part of the same digital ecosystem where predators lurk, waiting to exploit vulnerable individuals and children. Whether the social media platform is Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, a website, or TikTok, or some other product that's been created by big tech, activity is occurring on these platforms every single day that is threatening children. And social media has become a maelstrom for kids, pulling them into anxiety, depression, and death. Where there is smoke, there is fire, and big tech is fanning the flames. For too long, social media companies have insisted they're protecting kids, but their track record is littered with tragedy. And this is no time to trust but verify. It's time to regulate and enforce. We don't rely on cigarette companies to police themselves. We don't trust alcohol companies to decide when kids should drink. We don't let the arsonist put out the fire. So why are we letting social media platforms set the rules for protecting our children? These platforms are not passive. As Representative Stevens pointed out, they are engineered for addiction, and algorithms manipulate kids, distorting their reality and keeping them glued to the screen. And if that isn't bad enough, they are a legally sanctioned house of horrors for young people in Minnesota, the United States, and across the world. A house of horrors that is filled with sex trafficking, sextortion, legal drugs, suicidal ideation, suicide, and other predatory behavior. The need for warning labels is not the end-all be-all, but they are a start for an all-in solution. Parents have to be part of the solution, but parents need to be made aware of these harms, and that's the purpose behind a warning label. There is more that must be done, and big tech will do all they can, as they have and continue to tell you, these bills are unconstitutional. The most frequent argument they're going to make is that it's a First Amendment violation. But let's be honest. Does anybody in this room believe that that state senator or the websites that let him hunt for a child should be able to hide behind a free speech argument? Yet big tech opponents of this bill and every other effort to put common sense guardrails on social media argue that First Amendment protects big tech and their predators, and that lawmakers should reject any all efforts to regulate these platforms. Members of the committee, here is my First Amendment response to that argument. Baloney. The time for trusting big tech is over. The time to regulate and enforce is now. Every click has its cost, and it's time to regulate by putting labels on social media. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Tabitha Urbanski, and our last will be Zach Lilly, who is on Zoom. Tabitha, if you can make your way up. Please identify yourself for the record and begin.
My name is Tabitha Urbanski. First of all, I'd like to say good morning and thank you to this committee and Representative Stevenson, as well as the other authors of this bill. I said my name, Tabitha Urbanski, and I lost my 17-year-old son. This is my son. I lost my 17-year-old son, Seth, on October 26, 2022, to fentanyl poisoning. Seth had been out of rehab for 3 weeks, and he was doing really well. He was planning for his future and actively participating in a program to learn construction skills and obtain his high school diploma. He had been making plans for his upcoming birthday celebration, and he was excited about the future and the possibilities that lay ahead. The day before Seth died, he left his program early to buy Percocet after a dealer connected with him on Snapchat. He unknowingly received fentanyl instead. After going home, he went up to his room to lay down like any other teenager. I texted several times about dinner, his day, and good night, assuming he was sleeping and needed some space. He was home. I felt like he was safe. And we didn't know that he was struggling with his addiction that day. But I didn't hear back from him, not because he was sleeping, but because he was already gone. I would not find this out until the following morning when I went to wake him up for his program. At 7:38 a.m. the following morning, I found my beautiful son sitting at the end of his bed, dead. Small blue pieces of pills were still visible on his lips, but he was gone. There was no Narcan, no CPR, no medical interventions that could bring him back to me. He was gone. I have to live with that picture of my baby boy in my mind for the rest of my life. This is what I have left of my son, pictures. Pictures is what I have left of him. The concentration of the fentanyl was so strong, it was 3 times the lethal dose. He never had a chance. He has left behind 8 siblings, 3 parents, 4 sets of grandparents, and numerous other family. We went from planning his 18th birthday to planning a funeral all in the same week. My son battled his addiction for over 3 years, and most of his purchases were done via Snapchat. Seth once told me that phones were basically obsolete. Dealers were too paranoid. He said they used Snapchat to sell because they didn't have to worry about being caught. Social media not only fueled his depression and anxiety, but also played a critical role in his death. This bill is not the fix-all that's needed. It definitely is not, but it is a step in the right direction. So I'm here before you today to ask you all to move HL 1289 forward. It is time that we hold social media accountable for the damage their platforms are causing to our most vulnerable, our children. I stand here for my family, my son, and all the other families in Minnesota and across the country that I've met, and those that I have not, that should be planning futures and not funerals. Children should learn from their mistakes and not die from them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Urbanski, for your testimony, and I'm so sorry for your loss. We appreciate you sharing your story today. Our last testifier that signed up ahead of time is Zach Lilly with NetChoice. If you are available, if you could identify yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Zach Lilly with NetChoice. We're a trade association of leading tech companies dedicated to protecting free enterprise and free expression online. We have concerns with HF 1289 as it violates the First Amendment of the Constitution and would not be effective at improving the online experience for young people. People like to make comparisons between social media and other regulated goods and services, but these comparisons usually fall short. The reality is that social media platforms are speech platforms, and any attempt to regulate them needs to seriously contend with the First Amendment. HF 1289 violates the First Amendment in at least two ways. For one, the warning label would require the conveyance of a controversial message. There is no scientific consensus regarding the mental health effects of social media. Much more scientific study is needed. The courts have ruled labeling requirements must adhere to verifiable criteria, like calorie count. The type of warning label that HF 1289 would mandate is not fact, but rather a political opinion. The second issue is that speech is fundamentally different from calories or other product labeling requirements. Americans have a constitutionally protected right to express themselves and to engage in the expression of others. Would it be appropriate for the government to force a news station, newspaper, or blog of an independent journalist to publish a warning label about their writing? Is it the government's right to dissuade citizens from engaging with First Amendment protected speech? No. Instead, the government can focus resources on educating young people and parents directly instead of commandeering private platforms over how to keep themselves safe online. This could be done by teaching kids digital literacy while connecting parents and guardians with family control and monitoring tools that are already offered in the private sector. None of these concepts violate the First Amendment and would actually empower Minnesotans to stay safer online. Again, we respectfully ask that you not advance HF 1289. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lilly. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will move to member questions. Members, any questions for our bill author? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to also express our my sympathies to the testifier and her family. One of the things that I attempted to do in our co-chairing environment was to do educational programs for the committee, and we did a number of them. And one of the things that we were looking to try to accomplish but did not get done this session was to bring in folks who can talk about and inform the committee and educate the committee on algorithms. How do they work? How does data collection work? How do these systems ultimately roll up and go after certain persons in our society and in our culture and in our communities to be able to get a better understanding of how to work with the issue that's not only this issue that's before us today, but the other bills that are similar in nature to this. This concept has bipartisan support, and I just wanted to make sure that we let folks know that was one of the goals of this committee this year, was to learn more about that. And we may have some time after deadline to do that. We certainly may have some time next year as we continue this effort. But it is very important, and both members on the GOP side and the DFL side have appreciated those educational meetings and have told me that. And this is another one that's an extremely important one for us to have as lawmakers. So, Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Up next is Representative Kreshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the bill author. So, first of all, I'll just say I support this. I think that this is catching us up, and as we move to the digital platform, just like we've done with paper, print, and warning labels, is the right idea. A couple of things that I just want to offer as I could continue to give my support to the testifier who said the things they said about whatever they said. I'm just going to go this way. With the algorithms, the AI, and the programming, these tech companies can do this stuff very, very quickly. They have the means to do this. We know their algorithms. I write them. We see them. And so, you know, I see this as no different than being ADA compliant, making sure that we're going along the lines there with people with disabilities and preventing. There is no scientific evidence. That's not true. There is plenty of evidence. Go to the schools. You'll see it. So thank you for that. The one thing I do want to bring up, you don't necessarily have to give me an answer on this, but one of the things that I think we should address or you should look at is, and I don't know how we get to this, but the idea of the scamming or the false warning labels that you might see. I mean, we see this with the virus stuff all the time. I don't know how we get there, but the penalties should be such that if you are imitating a company with a false label like this and you take someone down and you, you know, we had an earlier bill about scamming and consumer protections, we should consider that. But by and large, thank you, Representative Stevenson. This will be a tough one to get ahead of, but we need to.
Thank you. And next is Representative Reimer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill to the committee today. Obviously, I understand the heart behind the bill. You know, right now my family is going through a screen fast, you know, and it's been really healthy for us and our kids to just stop watching Bluey all the time. My concern, I guess, is right now, like when you talk about social media advertisers, these are oftentimes small businesses who maybe can't afford a TV ad or can't afford a print ad, but can't afford the $3 or $4 a day you put towards social media. And if you go social media platform by social media platform, there's already severe restrictions, actual outright prohibition on things like guns, tobacco, THC and cannabis. If you're looking to advertise on social media platforms, I think they're figuring it out as our state is figuring it out. Pornographic content, and even if you go to Facebook or Instagram, you can't advertise scales because it promotes the ideal body image. And then there's also severe restrictions on financial products, housing, politics, credit offerings, and numerous other things. There's a lot of tools that are already available on social media platforms, like if you have an underage child, to limit the time that they use the social media platform in general. I didn't notice in your bill a specific call out of the age. It seems to impose this on all users. And my question for you is, if I'm a 34-year-old guy and I have total kind of free choice of my life, what in this bill kind of alleviates that on someone like me who's a consenting adult who fully knows what they're getting into?
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Reimer. First, I will just want to admit that I also feel inadequate compared to Bandit as a father. So I think, you know, maybe a fast on Bluey is a good idea. And I also did want to comment, you know, it occurred to me as I was listening you talk about the policies that these platforms have put in about their advertising, that is, in a way, an admission that these platforms have the impacts that we are saying that they do, right? Why else would they prohibit putting advertisements for scales if they didn't believe that there was a connection between what people see on Facebook and what they do in real life? If they didn't see a connection between excessive social media use and eating disorders, they would reject the idea that they should limit advertisements for scales. But to your question, this bill does require warning labels for all ages, because the evidence that I have seen has said that the effects are more strong on children, the mental health impacts, they do exist for adults as well, and adults should know. But for a 34-year-old or a 40-year-old or anyone else who's of age, the bill does not restrict any access to these platforms. It just provides a little bit of information. And frankly, you know, I get a little pop-up on my phone once a week that tells me how much time I've spent on my screen, and so once a week I feel embarrassed at how much time I spend on my phone this week. You know, and I do try and mitigate that, but it doesn't stop me. Like, I can still use my phone. It doesn't interfere with my right to use my phone as much as I want to get that pop-up saying, you know, I'm not even going to tell you how many hours a day I spend on my phone, because it's ridiculous. But I still have that ability as an adult to make that choice.
Members, we only have 5 minutes left. If you have a Representative Reimer, do you have a follow-up that's quick, or do you?
No, I'm good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do have a question, but to address one of the comments that it is not like cigarettes, it is, well, maybe not a perfect analogy, but they're both harmful addictions, and cigarettes have warning labels. Even my can of Monster here says, not recommended for children, people sensitive to caffeine, pregnant women, or women who are nursing. So we have warning labels on a lot of things. And looking at that from a First Amendment perspective, that is my question for you. What is your response, maybe a little more thorough than the other testifier, and you're an attorney, the First Amendment question? And just so I don't need a follow-up, I'm going to continue. So that's the one question. And the other comment I would have is, 30 minutes for a pop-up sounds infuriating. Like, I do have great concerns over that. I support the bill, well, at least moving the bill forward for sure, because this is an issue that we need to raise. And there's like phones in schools is another related issue. But having a child, especially a girl, a young girl with social media in their pocket every single day, is like giving every 13-year-old boy a gun. And that's something Jonathan Haidt talked about with the way the two genders associate differently with one another, with the relational damage and the physical aggression that you generally see in the respective genders. So this is an important issue, and we're seeing it in our kids. And as a father of two daughters, I care about it a lot. But I would like a more thorough answer to the First Amendment concerns that were brought up earlier. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Stevenson.
First of all, Representative West, phones in schools, 100% agree. In intros today is a bill that I'm carrying. Representative Nadeau is on as well to ban phones in schools. You might want to take a look at that. We can work on the pop-ups. It's a novel concept here, so happy to continue working on that and appreciate your comment there. On the First Amendment, you know, I reject the idea that this is a violation of the First Amendment. I think it's just a boilerplate response to any attempt we have to regulate social media. Members who have been on this committee before, we've had bills before to do social media stuff. Literally anything we do, they come in and say this violates the First Amendment. It's not true. Even if you ignore the fact that there's lots of products out there that have a requirement of warning labels, which defeats this mandated speech or the controversial speech argument that he made, even if you think the First Amendment is implicated, understand that the government can regulate speech if it has a compelling state interest, and what could be more compelling than protecting our kids? So I don't believe that this is a violation of the First Amendment. There are a lot of bills that have passed, including a bill that we passed last year on data privacy that impacts social media companies. Lots of states have passed that. It doesn't violate the First Amendment.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. And Representative Cha is our last member question.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Stevenson, for this bill. I have a background in computer science, so let me educate a little bit on this subject. With the Google quantum computer, it takes 6 seconds to compute what a computer would do in 47 years. This is the type of technology that these algorithms and companies are using to target our children and violating our privacy, okay? These quantum computers are continuously, every second of every day, finding ways to get into our children's digital device, into our consumer's head. They continue to do it, and they've been doing it for over 30 years since the inception of the internet in 1993. I think it is time, as a legislator in the state of Minnesota, that we take action to protect our children and our constituents. Thank you, Representative Steve.
Thank you, Representative Cha. And Representative Steve, I'm just going to make one quick comment before I let you wrap up, that I just wanted to point out that our testifier on Zoom stated that these social media platforms are platforms of free speech, and these are speech platforms, but I would respectfully disagree in the fact that these mediums are also conducting business, and they are a commerce tool. And so to be able to split that out and to split hairs and to say that it is one thing when it actually is multiple things, I would hate for us to start regulating them like commerce if they are unwilling to or unable to recognize that they are used for more than just a platform of free speech. And so I would maybe want to talk to you offline as to, as if mediums that are being used as commerce as well, how do we then look at how we regulate those pieces? And so I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. Representative Stevenson, if you have any wrap-ups to your bill.
Yeah, I'll be very brief, Madam Chair. I did want to recognize what Representative O'Driscoll said and appreciated, you know, we had conversations about that educational goal, and I think that was a great idea, and I understand that it just didn't come together because of people's availability, but I appreciate the effort to do that, and I'm glad that we're talking about doing it before. Minnesota really has been a leader in regulating social media and technology. We passed a number of bipartisan pieces of legislation for new members in the room, including comprehensive data privacy that I mentioned earlier, a leading ban on deep fakes. I think we were the first state in the country to regulate child social media influencers, which we did last year, prohibiting them under an age of 13. And I think I'm forgetting a few other. Oh, the transparency piece that we passed last year, which was also a first. So I appreciate the bipartisan support for this bill, and I'm committed to keep working on it with anybody who's interested.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. And before I go to the vote, I did just want to say, because I see people wrapping up, and I don't want everybody to leave before I say this, is I want to first apologize to the testifiers that came today to testify on Representative Elkins' bill. We had that on this slate to have that bill heard today, but we did not get to that. And so we hope that we'll be able to accommodate you in the future when we are bring the bill back to committee. And so my deepest apologies that you sat through a committee hearing, did not get to testify. With that, I renew the motion that House File 1289 be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 1289 is referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Members, there's no more business before us, and our committee is adjourned.